Okay, today is Monday, July 27th. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. I'm here interviewing Chris Peniston, is that how you say your last name? Mm-hmm. About her time on campus in the 80s. Chris, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name?
Hi, this is Chris. Hello?
My name
is Chris Peniston.
Okay, great, thank you. Try to get a touch closer to you.
Okay.
I may have to speak up a little bit to make sure my questions get heard. I'm not yelling at you. I'm just trying to make sure we get it on the recording.
Okay.
So the first question off the bat usually is, how did you end up at UW-Madison?
I grew up near Madison. I grew up in Belleville. So had always sort of had an idea that I would be going to college, and my parents didn't have any money to send me to any fancy college, so at that time UW-Madison was a fairly cheap alternative. This was the late 70s. I entered college in 1980, and I had also been part of the Wisconsin Youth Symphony as a high school student, so I came to campus Saturday mornings to practice with the Youth Symphony.
Okay.
Hi, this is Chris. Is this about a study? Okay, we're not looking for any more volunteers right now. You bet.
So, as part of the Youth Symphony, you came here to, here by campus to practice.
On Saturday mornings, we used to practice in the Humanities Building. So, as a high school student, I was familiar with the campus, having come up here every week for that. And then I also had friends who came to the UW-Madison. And they were active in the Teaching Assistants Association's strike. And as a high school student, I came to visit them. And I had familiarity with the campus through living close by and being here.
Okay. So you came here the fall of 1980, and soon after that, the election of 1980 changed things, I guess. Were you, as a teenager, politically active at all?
Not really. I was a very strong feminist and was kind of known in high school as being a feminist, but I didn't organize any activities around that.
Okay. So how did you feel then as a freshman entering UW-Madison after the election of 1980?
Prior to the election, in fact, that summer before college began in September of 1980, I actually moved to Madison and started working at the Memorial Union. And when I got there for that summer prior to school starting, I was exposed to others who were active in MULO, which was the Memorial Union Labor Organization, which represented all of us workers at the Memorial Union and Union South. And I would also became familiar through my coworkers with people who had been involved in the TAA strike, as well as people involved at that time in the Madison Committee Against Registration in the Draft, because that was an issue that was looming. And I forget now whether it was Carter who had reinstituted that or whether that was just a proposal, but I don't really recall. But anyway, that summer, prior to actually starting college, I became politicized through my coworkers at the union who had been involved, like I said, in the TAA and in MULO and other activities.
So an education before your formal education started.
And then as soon as the semester began in September, the campus all of a sudden, became exponentially larger. And I'll never forget, at the Memorial Union, there used to be able to request tables, information tables, we called them. And they were in the, right on the first floor there as you come into the Memorial Union. And there were all kinds of political groups that had tables, and they were, hawking their newspapers, putting up pamphlets. Groups like the Committee Against Registration in the Draft, political Marxist-Leninist organizations, of which there were several that were prominent on campus, the Proletarian Labor Organization, the Revolutionary Workers' Headquarters, many different kinds of Marxist-Leninist groups. And so every time you would walk into the union, every time I came to work, every time I went there just to socialize, you came and you walked by these tables. And that was a very interesting sort of ongoing dialogue that you were always confronted with. And then early that semester, maybe it was before the election, I don't recall, the Committee Against Registration, the draft, was very active, and I went to some very large meetings with co-workers at the union who took, who had been involved in that, and, really had my eyes opened as to the things that were going on. And then when Reagan got elected, right away he instituted budget cuts to financial aid. And that was probably the first political issue that I worked on was resisting and protesting against the cuts to financial aid for college students. And we got involved with the student government and many other, students were involved in that. And then shortly thereafter, Reagan called for the invasion of El Salvador. Well, he called it an invasion, but it was initially, high-level sort of training personnel. And then it became clear that the U.S. was providing arms to the government of El Salvador, which was engaged in a civil war against the people and the FMLN. So those were the very, very first issues that I kind of got involved with.
Okay. I want to get into some of those, but I want to back up and set the stage a bit more. So you just said you moved to Madison in the summer.
Yep.
Where did you live?
I lived in an apartment with a friend of mine at the Saxony, I think they're called, on Francis and Johnson Streets. And then, as I said, a high school teacher had actually put in the word for me at the lakefront cafeteria at the Union to get a job there. And so I started working there right away.
And so was that, I hate to use the word basic, but sort of basic cafeteria work?
It was. The cafeteria is very different now than it was at that time. At that time, the lakefront cafeteria was simply, you pick up your tray at the opening of the door, and you go down the line. Not at all like what it is today. But, so yeah, I was behind the scenes, serving meals, because you would serve people dinner on their plates and so forth. Setting up, cutting desserts, stuff like that.
So when the fall semester started, did you stay in the Saxony apartment?
No, actually, I moved into a dorm. I moved into Witte.
And what were your, I guess it's a little different because you had a little bit of adjustment to Madison, but I wonder what you thought of dorm life there that first semester or early on.
Well, my apartment at the Saxony was not much bigger than a dorm room, so the space thing didn't bother me. What it did do was expose me to a large group of people that eventually I sort of became known as the political activist, the rabble-rouser. I would always bring back to the dorm leaflets and flyers with me. So it sort of provided me with a ready group of people that I could circulate some of these ideas to. But I didn't spend a whole lot of time in dorm activities or anything like that.
So once fall semester started, you don't have to get into specifics if you don't remember, but just sort of in general, that first semester classes and
mm-hmm.
how it felt to be a college student academically.
Mm-hmm. Academically was not a challenge. I was just doing general courses, had really little idea what I was going to major in, and took some of the basic liberal arts, humanities type courses. I was actually in a program called the Integrated Liberal Studies Program, ILS. And it turns out that a lot of those people in ILS were also very politically minded. And so I went through a couple years kind of with this group in and out of various classes with them. And some of my best friends, actually one in particular I still have today from that, because it was sort of a community, and like I said, you took the same courses kind of with the same group of people. So that was my early introduction to campus. And then I decided fairly early on to take courses in African American history. At that time, it was called the Afro-American Studies Department. And we had some pretty great faculty there. Tom Schick, who's now dead, but he was a professor there, and I took practically all of his courses. Herbert Hill was also a professor of Afro-American history. Both of them very influential on me. And taking those courses, studying Black history and civil rights, and just the whole situation of Blacks in the U.S. was also part of the politicizing process that I and my friends went through early on in those college years.
Even though you weren't involved with it directly, at least it doesn't, I don't think you were, you mentioned a couple of times the TAA strike in 1980, which is sort of a big thing on our campus.
And it was over. So when I came, it had been over.
Right.
So, yeah.
But do you recall, you said you had friends who were involved, just sort of secondhand, do you recall what, at least how your friends felt about sort of the strike itself and then the aftermath?
Yeah, well, they were supportive. They were, these friends in particular were a year ahead of me. So, as I said, when they were living in the dorms, their first year of college, I was a high school student, came up to visit them, and they were really involved in it as undergrads in support of the graduate students who were teaching assistants. And it was just sounded very exciting, and I really had no reservations about uniting with their support of the TAs. It made sense to me, even though I wasn't from like a union family or anything like that.
So early on, you got involved, or at least became a member of MULO.
Mm-hmm.
What was your involvement in that organization?
So I went to meetings and became a steward, and really wasn't very active. I mean, they were active in supporting the TAA. They were active in various campus issues. They were really, it was like a multi-issue organization. It wasn't just about representing workers' rights, because wasn't that many worker issues to deal with, but there were some. And so we would get involved in like grievances, you know, for work situations in the cafeteria or the Rathskeller. So I was sort of peripherally involved in that. But the bigger thing I became involved with, and it was in the fall of 1980, was the founding of the Progressive Student Network.
Okay.
And these other things, the registration and the draft, and MULO and the vestiges of the TAA strike and everything was sort of just laid the groundwork for my becoming involved in the group of people who founded the BSN.
Well, let's talk more about that then. So first off, why don't we talk about what the PSN was about?
So I had joined a Marxist-Leninist group, and we believed that we saw that there was a high level of political activity on the campus having to do with the TA strike, but also just the 70s in general had been very politically active. So things were really sort of cooking, if you will. And then with the election of Reagan and the involvement in El Salvador, which was a very hot issue, and the Sandinistas started their quest for power in Nicaragua shortly thereafter. So all of that was percolating, and then there was all this anti-nuclear activism. So we said, in this group, we said, let's unite all these single issue groups and let's provide a forum for all of them to come together in a very large student organization nationally with campus affiliations, campus affiliates. So it was sort of an idea that there was all these single issue groups out there and involving lots of people, and that, you know, to further build what we were trying to build was ultimately a revolutionary movement that we would need to form these broad coalitions of already active people. And that was really the key. Not just, of course, we were trying to recruit people and involve people that had never been active, but everybody was active at that time, so it sort of seemed like that was efficient and effective. You know, why not already organized groups of people? And in fact, it was wildly popular. 1980 was 10 years after the shootings at Kent State, in our memories, even though I was not very old at that time. I learned about it by that time I got to college, and we thought it was a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Vietnam was only over, you know, like 5-6 years by that point.
Exactly. So things were still very hot, and there had been Roe v. Wade, you know, so women's rights and abortion was, you know, hot issue, because then there were people trying to reverse or take back Roe v. Wade, certain legislators. There was one guy from Chicago or Illinois, and I can't think of his name, Henry Hyde, maybe. And he was trying to reverse Roe v. Wade, and so there was all kinds of women's groups active. As I said, there was the growing anti-nuclear movement that really sort of reached its peak, I think, in 82, and we had a rally in New York of about 1 million people. So, there was already lots of activism. 60s and 70s weren't that far off in people's minds. And a lot of the people that I was involved with on campus were older. So they had been there in the 70s. And they had had a lot of, you know, experience.
You know, before we get to more about PSN, I want to go back again, if you don't mind. You know, you said you weren't necessarily active pre-UW, but you were considered a feminist, or consider yourself a feminist. I'm wondering how, you know, by the time you were in high school, you had identified as that.
Well, it wasn't difficult because I grew up in the 70s, so born in 62. And the feminist movement, Gloria Steinem, the founding of Ms. Magazine, which I subscribed to as a high school student, that was all happening. And as I said, Roe v. Wade, 72, I think. And I was just aware of these things. I don't know why. I guess because we all were. And I was just very outspoken at my high school. And, you know, as I said, became sort of known for being outspoken. And I don't know why I mean, I didn't find that my friends were all that different minded than me. But for some reason, I was just outspoken about it. Mm-hmm. I was a leader. I mean, in high school, I was a leader. I led, you know, I did the yearbook, organized that. I mean, I did various other sort of leadership type things.
So even though you didn't consider yourself sort of politically active, it sounds like the seeds were sort of sown in high school to at least be able or willing to be organized or to help organize once you got to college.
I would say so. Definitely. Like I said, I was in leadership capacities. I was elected to give one of the speeches at high school graduation. You know, it was, I guess, just having that. I came from a small school, so maybe it was kind of easy to stand out. I don't know. But, yeah, I guess I would say some of that I brought with me.
Okay. So... How did you and others then really truly bring together the PSN? I mean, you talked about how it sort of brought all these single issue groups together, but how does one do that?
Boy, a lot of leafleting. We kept some printers in Madison in business, and in those days there was no computers, so we would lay out all of our posters and leaflets using these rub-on sort of letters that you would buy at the bookstore, and you would painstakingly rub the letters onto the paper, and if you wanted it to look nice. I mean, otherwise you could just handwrite it and get that printed, but a lot of posters, a lot of leaflets. I think a lot of people have saved those, hopefully turned them over to the archives. And we would just make the rounds, you know, go to dorms, put up posters in classrooms, get other people to announce it at their meetings. There was all kinds of meetings every day. There was this thing at the union, Memorial Union, called TITU, Today in the Union. And it was, there was no computer, so you had to go actually to the board at the union and look, and you could go on any given day and see what political groups were meeting. And you'd say, oh, well, you know, MCARD is meeting tonight, make sure you get some leaflets there so they can talk about our event or our meeting or whatever. Or let's get invited to their meeting and talk about this group we're founding. So every night there was a meeting, and We went to a lot of meetings. We talked about it. Organized. I think probably the biggest thing was people could see us active on campus, so they could see us as the leaders of, you know, the fighting the cuts to financial aid. They could see us as the leaders of the people leading, you know, organizing protests against U.S. involvement in El Salvador. Buttons. We had buttons. I still have the button from that. And it was hard work because it's not as easy as just email or Facebook. You had to do everything by foot and in person. And we were up late at night. We would spend all day working and leafleting and sometimes going to class, going to work, and then hanging out at the 602 later on and then dropping into bed.
So when the PSN started having meetings, do you recall physically where they were held?
Always at the union. So we would request a room at the union, and you had to do that by calling the room's reservation person, and if you had a idea that you wanted to meet at a certain time on a certain day every week, you could get that sort of standing appointment, which we did. But yeah, it was always at the Memorial Union. Sometimes they would, if there was so many meetings going on, which there, sometimes there was, we'd have to meet in a room in Humanities. That would be where the overflow room was. but leading up to the big meeting we had at Kent State to found the PSN, we were very active in all these things that I was mentioning, and so brought with us a good number of people.
So when was that meeting at Kent State? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
Was it during your freshman year?
Yeah, because it was 10 years after the shootings at Kent State. So it must have been early on in the semester. It must have been in the fall or...
Okay.
Things happened quickly. And because I'd been there all summer, I really knew the lay of the land.
Mm.
And then after the PSN, you know, we came back very rejuvenated because there was tons of campus people there. I don't remember the number of the people at the conference, but we, of course, judged it as wildly successful. And tons of people involved at various campuses on the East Coast, in the Midwest. Pretty much that's where it was centered, East Coast and Midwest.
So was it after that meeting that you realized you were onto something with the PSN, or was it even before that in Madison where you realized that this was actually a network that was, I'll use the word viable, but it's probably not the right word.
Yeah, no, I think we knew we were onto something when, you know, we were recruiting people to come to our rallies who were otherwise only involved in their single issue. So, you know, we sort of felt like we were helping to bring people out of their myopia and out of their meetings into the broader, you know, sort of environment. And in doing so, I think we created a sense of power in numbers. I mean, you know, the draft people could call a rally and get 50 people to show up, and the same with, you know, women's, you know, rights activists. But when we called a rally, it'd be 400 because everybody, you know, we were very active. We had a presence in many issues. We would send people to be representatives at these single issue groups. So, you know, we kind of saw it as a way of bringing back the big movements of the 70s that we'd all heard about.
So how did you, or how do you recall balancing then, you know, trying to organize, help to organize PSN, but then also, you know, be a student your first semester or your first year at school?
Well, I became pretty much a horrible student. You know, I never flunked out and finished with a pretty good GPA, 3.5 or something, but I took easy classes. I mean, or the classes I took weren't demanding or something. I don't know. But it wasn't an issue. I skipped a lot of classes, but always did my final papers and always did my exams. And some classes I went to a lot because I liked them, like the Black Studies classes. Richard Ralston was another Black Studies professor, faculty member whose courses I took. And he taught about South Africa and struggle against apartheid, which was still active then. And he talked about traveling in South Africa in the trunk of a car to gather oral histories, like what you're doing. and really opened up my eyes to, you know, international political struggles. So yeah, I went to some courses, others I kind of blew off, and I wasn't taking that many courses. It took me 7 years to get an undergraduate degree because I was working full-time and I was very politically active.
So we talked a lot about the first year. Well, actually, there's one other thing. You mentioned the fact that you went to the sort of the 602 club at the end of the night before.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you talk a little bit about, not necessarily specifically the 602 club, although if you want, but the idea of also sort of balancing activism, but also trying to have some type of social interaction too, or were they always?
It was intertwined. I mean, we had just, you know, we had a lot of fun hanging out. and there was a core of us in the PSN that were, you know, the diehards, you know, the people organizing everything. And then there was people on the periphery, and they were always welcome, you know, to be involved. But we found ourselves more or less with the same group of people. And it was a very big, strong bonding experience. And again, I still know some of these people today and talk with them. So it was that socialization at the end of the day after the meetings was a time, you know, to really unwind and bond and be social.
So who were some of these people that first year that were in the PSN or people that, well, I guess they probably were in the PSN, but people,
yeah,
who, these like-minded folks you've mentioned a couple of times.
So the leader of it all, really, and person who got me involved and who really should be credited with the PSN founding, at least in Madison here, is Bill Silver. And he's now a union organizer in Chicago. Chip Young, who's a professor of history. I think, last time I checked, I think he was in Arkansas at a college there. and then Dave Steger, who's a teacher now in the Detroit area, very active in his union. And Sheila Matlin, Julie Eisenberg, Andy Datesman, Edward Kastenmeier, Bob Kastenmeier's son. Bridget Sheridan, Maggie Brennan, Joe Mingle, Chip Mitchell, and all these people are either, you know, in academia or union organizers, or, you know, a lot of them still pretty political, and certainly in their outlook and their perspective and in their lives.
And these were all folks that you met for the most part that first year?
Yep. I might have the years wrong. I mean, I know Bridget Sheridan, Maggie Brennan, probably Joe Mingle were younger than me, so they probably didn't come around until a couple of years later. But
it sounds like, as you know, your sophomore year, there were people like you, freshmen coming in, who,
yep,
were motivated to be a part.
Yep.
So as the years went along, did you continue to be involved in PSN?
So yeah, we organized a lot of people, buses, to go to this big rally in New York. It was a anti-nuclear rally. I think there was like a million people there. It was one of the biggest rallies ever. And I think that was 82. I'm not really sure. And there was a lot of protests, a lot of organizing on campus that we were involved in. And then 84 was sort of another upsurge of activity because Reagan was running for re-election. And we organized this thing at the beginning of the school year, the Rock Against Reagan. And we said, you know, let's hit people at the beginning of their school year here, because we recognize that from all of us pretty much as being a real open time. You come to college, you see all these tables when you go into the union, there's all these information tables, you can't walk by without somebody telling you about something. And so we organized, put a lot of time into organizing this sort of all-day extravaganza on Library Mall. And we had bands lined up and all kinds of speakers from all different issues and just a big party, and but with a political theme. And it was hugely successful. People still have the posters from that event. It was hugely successful, and that was kind of how we started that year. And then as that year went on, I think Jesse Jackson ran that year for president. So there was, we got involved in the Rainbow Coalition, which was very, and this might have happened, started in 83, leading up to the 84 election. But that was, you know, his presence in the campaign was extremely politicizing to a lot of people. And of course, just the thought of another 4 years of Reagan, you know, after, you know, this involvement in El Salvador, which by that time had been exposed as, you know, for what it was, the U.S. just helping a dictatorship. And it was probably around that time we were also organizing protests about on campus against CIA recruiters. We became kind of known for that because every time there would be a recruiter, and they'd usually be like around Union South or on the engineering side of campus, we would, you know, block entrances. We even try to have people go in there as fake recruits and sort of disrupt the process.
So it sounds like your involvement in politics was on campus. I'm just wondering if there were other sort of off-campus political activity you started to become involved in.
By off-campus, you mean like...
Anything that is not necessarily directly tied to UW-Madison, but tied more towards either Democratic politics or union politics statewide or more citywide or...
Well, I mean, the anti-apartheid movement, you know, I guess you could call it a college movement, but that was a movement or an area where we really did form coalitions and ties with the labor community. So... That was pretty big. I think that was 85. And what we were doing on campus was trying to get the university to divest its funds from South Africa. And we also became aware that the state of Wisconsin had, as part of their investment portfolio, funds invested in South Africa. So we, you know, again, united with some of the unions, the labor unions around town, who had people that worked for the state, and formed, you know, a sort of citywide coalition against apartheid, which culminated, of course, everybody remembers this, the takeover of the state capitol and the governor's office.
Was that when, was that Governor Earle, or was that after?
You know, I think Earl had lost in 84, didn't he?
I know, I can't remember when he lost to Tommy. It was Tommy Thompson,
yeah,
that he lost to.
I'm pretty sure he was out.
Okay.
I think. I can't remember now.
It seemed to make more sense that Tommy Thompson would be the governor if he were...
Yeah, although we would have protested. I mean,
right.
Whatever.
Right.
I just remember people dancing on the table in the governor's office. I'm pretty sure Earl was out at that point.
Okay. All right. We can figure that out. That's easy. Let's see what else I want to ask this time before we wrap up. So, were there things, we talked about Roe versus Wade, but were there other things in PSN that allowed you to really tap into your strong feminist interests?
Well, pretty much everything we did, you know, had something to do with, you know, people's rights in general, and that's a core of feminism is, you know, self-determination and you know, the things that had happened in El Salvador were pretty overwhelming. The murder of the nuns, for example, although it wasn't a feminist issue, it certainly cut to the core of one of the tactics that's used, you know, in wartime, and it disproportionately affects women in some cases, as that situation certainly did. I was involved in Women's Transit Authority, so I volunteered all through college and all during this time. One night a month, I think it was, as a driver for Women's Transit Authority, and that's been dried up now a long time ago. But I would take like the late night shift, and we would organize rides for women in the community who didn't have money to pay for a cab. So I kept doing that, but other than that, I wasn't involved in any women's groups per se. But you know, a lot of what we did in the PSN in terms of our meetings and our national meetings was talk about women's rights, because we were pretty well aware of some of the problems in the 60s and 70s with groups and the male dominance in those groups. And there was hardly a meeting where we didn't have some discussion, you know, introspective sort of discussion about our functioning and our speakers lists, and were they inclusive enough. And so we talked about that a lot, and about running meetings. You know, in Madison it was weird because I was the leader of this group after Bill Silver left. And even while he was around, I was sort of emerging as the leader. And so it wasn't like the other sort of chapters where I think women did have to fight a little harder to sort of become leaders. In Madison, it really was, you know, me, and then I recruited other women to help lead. So I think we were maybe ahead of the game in that respect. But yeah, we were always very well aware of, you know, hanging on to the good things about the previous activism, but also getting rid of some of the bad things. And that was really famous, you know, how the SDS leaders kind of disrespected women.
So can you talk a bit more about the Women Transit Authority? And let me start by asking, was it a campus city?
It was campus, but we really serviced women in the community, mostly Black women, actually. And I remember it was the first time I'd ever driven in some of the parts of Madison that I was exposed to. And a lot of Black women, some women with children. So we were a campus entity, and I think we got some funds from the university, maybe segregated funds or whatever, I don't know. But we serviced primarily community women. Occasionally there'd be a call for a woman on campus, you know, ride back to her apartment or her dorm. But as I was a driver, most of the time it was servicing community women who were not college students.
We currently talk about the racial divide in Madison, and you sort of alluded to that, but it sounds like this was an opportunity for you in the 80s to see the racial divide.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't the diversity at UW-Madison or the attention to it that there is now. There's a lot of multinational students at UW-Madison, and I was exposed for the first time in my life to, you know, students from Iran and other parts of the world. But there wasn't that many Black students, and certainly not that much Black leadership in the student movement. You know, through my Black Studies courses at the UW-Madison, and my already sort of, my previous interest in Black culture and Black history, Women's Transit Authority provided me with an opportunity to sort of become familiar within our community of Blacks. And I remember there was a big deal in Milwaukee, a white police officer shot a Black man, and there was we had buses from Madison to Milwaukee, and that was a real key sort of racial issue, and one that we, you know, sort of were active around, but that wasn't happening in Madison.
Maybe one more thing for today. I promised I would get us done by 3, but I want to go back one more time to when you came to college, the Iranian hostage situation was still happening. I mean, Reagan's, the hostages were released when Reagan was inaugurated or around that time.
Yep.
I'm wondering, as you know, where I grew up in rural Idaho, you know, what the Iranians did to the American embassy folks was bad, and that there wasn't a lot of nuance.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, you know, here in Madison, was there nuance to that issue?
You know, that's an interesting question, and I think it may have to do with the exodus from Iran of really politically active and progressive people. And as they were leaving Iran, which would have probably been before the hostage crisis, they were coming to the U.S. and entering college. The Iranian students I knew were some of the most progressive and politically active students. And I never thought of them as being part of, you know, Iran hostage holding. They were just student activists. We had a lot of Arab student activists. There was a very, very active Arab league because Palestinian rights was also one of those single issues that was out there and being, you know, organized around. And we had formed a lot of ties and coalitions with these progressive Arab activists. But, you know, I wonder if maybe, you know, because people had left Iran and maybe some of the other countries where there were dictatorships propping up, the progressive people left. And where did they go? They came here, you know, to places like Madison. And I think they really infused the setting, you know, the university setting with sort of internationalist type of ideas. It was a real eye-opener for me. I'm from Belleville, which is all white, rural, farm people, you know, maybe not unlike Idaho. And just the multiculturalism here was just astounding. And I learned a lot from it, from listening to people talk about what it was like, where they came from. There was Ethiopian students here, Arab students, Iranian students. And they all had organizations. You know, it's not like today where I don't think there's as many different student organizations as there used to be, but they all had organizations, you know. The Progressive Iranian Students Organization, Progressive Palestinian Students Organization. They were all meeting.
Understanding that I'm coming back in a week or so to do a follow-up interview to make sure we catch some more stuff. Is there anything on your mind today that you want to make sure we get on the recording before we wrap up?
Well, some things I don't really remember the timing of at all, but, you know, another important way that we communicated or protested and got a lot of media attention was by being satirical. So when we intervened or invaded Grenada, I forget when that was, 83, maybe 82, I don't know. I remember, I don't know if you remember, but when the people came back from Grenada, the Americans, they kissed the ground when they got off the plane. So we had this protest where we sort of, it was like guerrilla theater, and we acted out, you know, the invasion, and then we had somebody kiss the ground in sort of making fun of, essentially, you know, the rescuing of the Americans from Grenada. And we also did some pretty interesting protests against Reagan. We formed this group called Macho Nerds for Reagan and Girl Geeks for the Gipper. And we went to Oshkosh, and we went, because I think Reagan was speaking there, stumping there, as he was running for one of his elections, probably 84. And then around Madison, we did a lot of events where we would dress up as, like I said, Macho Nerds for Reagan, or Girl Geeks for the Gipper, and those always attracted a lot of attention. You know, we'd maybe be at a protest and we'd sort of do a little guerrilla theater, or maybe we'd just sort of randomly, you know, do the guerrilla theater. But those were important ways that, and some people were attracted to that, and so I think we recruited and got some people to hang around us because we did that kind of stuff as well as what you might call the hardcore, you know, politicizing stuff.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for your time today. So this concludes the first interview with Chris Peniston. Thank you.
Sure.